Welcome to the Food and Faith Podcast, conversations from the soil and around the table with your co-hosts Anna Wolfenden and Sam Chamlin.
It is our pleasure to have Courtney Ellis on the podcast today. Courtney and I have decided that we're longtime old friends, but just realized today this is the first time that we have communicated via anything other than text and Slack and Twitter and Facebook. Yeah. But we are thrilled to have her on the podcast, and I do consider her a dear old friend. We have the joy of being in a writing group together and gotten to see how some of this writing has come to be. And we are so ridiculously excited that your first book, Uncluttered, is alive and in the world. And for those who are watching our video, I have it right here. I've read the whole thing in the last 48 hours, and it's just been a total joy. So, Courtney, we're so glad to have you on the show today.
Thank you for having me. It's an honor to be with you guys.
So we like to start off our podcasts with a question that we ask all of our guests, which is, what is your geography? What is the land, the food, the culture, and the space that has shaped you as an author, as a pastor, as a parent, as a human being? And maybe how has that shaped you to be talking about uncluttering and this book project?
I'm a child of the Midwest. I grew up in northern Wisconsin, Eagle River, Wisconsin, little woodsy town. My family lived on the edge of a lake, and many of my earliest memories are about food. We had a big farmhouse table, and we'd sit there with our family or with our friends, and my family has some German heritage, so we bake. We bake all the things all the time. My mom bakes, my dad bakes, my sisters and I would bake. And so a lot of the dinner time was kind of waiting for dessert, because dinner is fine, but dessert is even better. So I grew up thinking a lot about, before I even realized I was thinking about it, thinking a lot about what it was to gather around a table and those warm feelings that come from knowing there's a great meal in front of you and there's something even better yet to come. One of the things you realize when you grow up in a cold climate is that produce is really, really special. You wait for those blueberries because they're going to be in and out in a month. And there are several seasons, fall, winter, the beginning of spring, where you have wooden apples and wooden oranges and you can eat them. But man, you know, we did a lot of fruit cocktail in the can as kids because that's what there was. So I live in Southern California now, my husband and I and our three kids, and the magic of being able to walk into a grocery store and get blueberries, fresh, beautiful blueberries, almost any season of the year has not gotten old. We've been here 4 years and it feels like magic. But I also find myself a little bit nostalgic for tasting that first blueberry when you haven't had one for 11 months. And what a powerful experience it is to live in some sort of scarcity and then be blessed with a gift like that. So there are pros and cons to living both places, and I'm grateful that I've been able to experience both places. So that's where I came from, and that's where
what's
I am
your
now.
Best thing to bake?
Best thing to bake. Well,
what's your favorite thing to bake?
Yeah, and unfortunately for someone from a baking family, I found out a number of years ago that I have celiac disease. So that kind of threw me into a whole, baking becomes a chemistry experiment when you can't use gluten anymore. But I would say I have young kids, so we're kind of a cookie house now. We bake a lot of cookies because those are good. You can give a kid a cookie and send them outside, which they need to be outside. So we've got some of those, what are they called? Peanut butter blossoms with the Hershey Kiss on them. We've got some of those on the counter right now. My son is like, when I get home from school, mommy. I'm like, yes, yes, when you get home from school.
So Courtney, yeah. You've written this book called Uncluttered. What's it all about?
The book is a story of my journey from just having too much of everything to finding God wanting to give me just enough. It's funny because my life is a comedy in a lot of ways. But it's also an invitation. It's not a how-to book in any respect. It's a story of the way God has met me in letting go, in doing less, in logging off, and given me so much more than I ever could have imagined in those open spaces.
I was struck in your book that you talk about the difference between consuming and creating. And I think that you talk a bit about baking in that section, but also about gardening. And I just wonder if you could maybe tell us a little bit more about your reflections on what changes when you're focusing on creating rather than consuming.
Creating shapes us in a way that consuming doesn't. Consuming, you show up, you buy something, you eat it, it's gone. It was a really short transaction. But when you create food, whether it's baking or gardening or making some beautiful dinner, you're invested and you pay attention and your senses kind of wake up in a way that they don't when you're just moving on to the next thing. So I wasn't a gardener. I grew up so far north that gardens were very short-lived, and my mom tried and the deer came in our yard and ate everything and she just got frustrated. But my first pastorate was in rural Wisconsin, way down south, right on the border of Illinois, where the dirt is black and you can grow anything. It feels like Narnia, where you plant the lamppost and it'll grow. So my husband and I started a garden, and it was just amazing. You know, you plant seeds and things sprout up, and we were so new to gardening that we would just walk through the garden section of the store and buy seeds and plant them without really thinking about it. And then suddenly we had 8 million tomatoes and we're like, we don't really like tomatoes. Like, what have we done? We plant food we want to eat. We were so green at the whole thing. But that magic of being able to grow things, of sitting our tiny 1-year-old in the middle of that garden and letting him pick things and get dirty. And, you know, that process of creation is so much more, it's so much more spirit-led in a way, because we put the seeds in the ground, but we can't make things grow. We can't make the weather be decent or the sunshine or any of those things. And so being able to just sit and observe and watch the things happen, it's magic. It's amazing. I was a decent gardener by the time we left rural Wisconsin. Now that I live in Southern California, I'm learning the importance of water. Yeah. And all of our beds died last year. I think I missed 2 days in a row and that was it. You just can't come back from that. It's a desert. But we are learning again. We are learning again. My son was out in the yard yesterday and he said, "Mommy, there's kale." And I was like, yes. Like, and my son's excited about kale. This is amazing.
I just think it does just change kids' whole experience of vegetables, I think, when they can grow them themselves and see, like, this is exciting. And
it's
also,
like, can I try it? Like, yes.
Yes. Yes. Yes. That is a leaf you can eat. And Southern California, that year-round growing season. I know it took me a few years even just to understand that I could grow things all year round, and that actually in the winter, maybe I could grow more things because it wasn't too hot.
Right.
Yeah. I'm sitting over here going, oh, you're getting kale now. I'm like, oh, I got months to wait before I can harvest anything.
But yours will taste better because you had to wait for it.
That's right. Well, it makes me think too. So one of the things I found most challenging and inspiring about your book was your chapter on technology. And thinking particularly in a situation with children, and just how, I mean, so many of us are addicted to screens, and we certainly see this epidemic in this country, maybe globally, of children who have access to screens just starting to live their whole lives in that world. And just thinking about when we can put some boundaries around screen time, that suddenly opens up this excitement for, like, radishes, you know, like, yeah. that's strangely countercultural in a way that maybe it wasn't even 30, 40, 50 years ago, that this is actually starts to become this novel thing of, oh, there's dirt and there are worms and we could grow tomatoes. Yeah. But then it requires actually putting a boundary around something else, that it requires having some kind of clear intention of what it is you're going to put your energy towards.
Mm-hmm. And technology is almost always the fastest and the easiest thing. So for us to develop an appetite for slower, harder things, I love the way you put it. We have to put boundaries. We have to put borders around some of those technological things. Because if I ask my son, do you want to go out and work in the garden with me? Sometimes he's like, yes. And sometimes he's, But if I say, do you want to watch a show? It's always yes, right? It's always yes. And so having to learn, and I'm wired the same way, you know, I'm in my 30s and I'm no better. And I grew up in kind of an analog world where there weren't any smartphones. So what chance do our kids have unless we help them manage that at this young age? They'll never learn to love the radishes if they're constantly on their screens. It's a gift that we can give them. And it's a hard gift. I have three young kids and putting them on screens is incredibly tempting because then they're quiet and they're contained and I can shower and know that no one's lighting anything on fire, right? It's great, but it's got to be kept in a certain place because I want my kids to grow into adults who understand and love the deeper things in life and not just the easiest and the fastest things.
Now, one of the things that I saw in your book is talking about how making these decisions to be uncluttered leads us towards joy. And so I wonder, and I know so many parents who struggle because they feel like they're taking joy away from their children. And sometimes by, you know, reducing that or putting up those boundaries. And so sometimes just giving permission and hearing a story that somebody else did this to a positive end is really life-giving. So I wonder in your life, if there's been a time where you're like, look, we got to put a boundary on this screen, but it actually produced joy in the life of your child or your children rather than taking it away.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's hard to kind of feel like you're the weirdest family on the block, you know?
Yeah.
We're like, we're doing this because we love you. Like, but every other kid has seen Star Wars. I'm like, you're 6 years old. Yeah. So there's a, you know, it's tricky. But when we started this journey, my husband and I realized we needed to pare down technology and that we needed to do that. When I started writing the book, our oldest son was only about 3 years old. But one of the things we did was when he woke up from his nap, we would let him watch TV and not for a long time, but he'd get to pick a show. And so it's either 20 minutes or it's 40 minutes. And we realized he took a kind of long nap and then he would watch his show and then he would kind of detox from his show for the next hour. And then it was dinner and then it was bath and then it was bed. And the whole afternoon was either napping or detoxing from television. And so we thought we got to pull the show. And you know how you kind of get scared of your own kids sometimes? You're like, this is going to go badly. This is terrible. This is going to be in his memoir. He's going to need therapy. He's going to choose a terrible nursing home for us someday. But we bit the bullet and we sat him down and, you know, he's three and we're like, you know what? We're only going to watch a show now on our Sabbath, our family Sabbath. We're pastors. So our family Sabbath is Friday. You can pick any show you want on Friday. The rest of the time we're going to play instead. We're going to play. We're going to read books. You want to go to the park, we'll go to the park. And he thought about it for a minute and there were a couple of tears, but like a couple. Mm. And then he was like, okay. And he would wake up from his nap and suddenly he'd be like, can we go outside? Rather than turning it into a little zombie. And it was more work for us because I could count on that nap and then another half an hour where I could write, I could get church emails done. And so it was a sacrifice on our end, but it changed our family. Suddenly it wasn't just this zombie, this is what we do. It was this opportunity to connect and to be together. And he didn't mind it nearly as much as we had feared, which was a lesson to us that kids are a little bit more flexible when it comes to the screen time than adults sometimes. You know, I'm like, sign me out of Twitter. Like, I need, get me off of this. But I love Twitter. Twitter's great.
With boundaries, right? Everything
about Twitter with boundaries. Twitter. My husband actually.
That's right. Follow all of us on Twitter.
But the solution I've come to recently, and this isn't in the book, it's just been the past couple months for myself on Twitter. Twitter's my drug. I love Twitter. Twitter is fun and no one can see my house if it's a mess, so it's great. I've given my passwords. Well, I've not given them. I've asked my husband to change my passwords. And I'm like, don't let me on until the kids are in bed. Uh-huh. And there are days I'm like, I just need to check in. And he's like, yeah, no, sorry, because I love you. You're the one who told me to change the passwords. And it's changed my life. Because what technology does so often is just a second, just a minute. I'm just going to check one more time. But those minutes, seconds turn into hours where I'm looking at this rather than the person across from me, or the book I want to read, or the laundry that needs to be folded. You know, it's, there's a whole world out there, but we give our time away in seconds and minutes, and then it's gone.
Well, I really appreciate hearing that really practical piece, because my experience of you is that you're very active on social media. You have a great presence. Like I feel like you're paying attention to all of us out into the Twitterverse.
That's good to hear.
Well.
I am between 7:30 and 9 p.m.
Yeah.
That's my time. Yeah.
So I just think that that's inspiring to me, because I think that I wrestle with, but if I don't check, then I'm going to miss all these things, and I'm not going to have the connection with people I want to have. And maybe somebody's going to, you know, maybe a friend's going to post something hard and sad on Facebook and I'm going to miss it. But what I've found is it turns out that, you know, when I take a 24-hour technology Sabbath and I come back, I just check my notifications, you know, or...
Right. It's still there.
It's still there. But it's such... It just... That... I guess that bit of a seed of... That I think is true of there's something good about connecting can become...
Absolutely.
The gateway to it having to happen all the time. So I just appreciate that really practical, like that, yes, you do Twitter and you are engaged, but it's within a certain window.
I love Twitter. Twitter's great.
Twitter is great.
But it's like dessert, right? You can't eat it all the time or bad things happen.
Yeah.
Right. Kind of on that note, would you be willing to share with us a bit more about practically what Sabbath looks like for your family, and what boundaries do you hold, and how did you come to them?
Yeah, absolutely. Sabbath shifts for us when our kids are at different ages. It's different when you have a baby than when you have a kindergartner. For the longest time, Friday was our Sabbath. We would wake up in the morning. Our kids would get their one show a week so we could sleep in. Glory, hallelujah. But now our oldest is in kindergarten. So he, you know, the public schools frown upon you pulling your kid out every Friday because you're having a family Sabbath. So he gets out of school at 2 p.m. And so it's 2 p.m. Friday to 2 p.m. Saturday now is our Sabbath. We get our 24 hours. It's more like a traditional Jewish Sabbath, sundown to sundown almost. And one of the tricky things about Sabbath rest with young kids is they don't play by the rules. You know, you can't say it's Sabbath. We're all going to sleep in till 9. The baby's like, ha-ha, uh-huh. Right. I'll sleep in till 9, but I'm going to nurse at midnight and 3 and 6. And yeah, so Sabbath for us, I love Eugene Peterson's description of Sabbath, which is that it should be a day for praying and playing. Mm-hmm. So worship is a piece of it for us. My husband and I try to give each other some dedicated time alone with the Lord. We make sure that our kids understand why we're doing Sabbath. It's not just about the donuts, though the donuts are very important. But then we play. You know, we go for a walk as a family. We play in the garden. We have great neighbors on our cul-de-sac, and the kids are playing foosball or basketball. My husband and I try to be outside as much as we can. But with young kids, another crucial piece is we give each other some time alone to do whatever. I usually nap right now. We have a newborn, and all I want in the world is to nap. But you know, I feel God's blessing on that nap. Like, you've worked hard and I'm here and the work is mine. Don't fold the laundry, lay down. Sabbath gives us permission to leave things undone for 24 hours a week. The kids still have to eat, right? We still have to feed them. We still have to change the diapers. Can't be like, oh, it's my Sabbath. But there are ways to rest even in the midst of having little kids and a lot on the plate. So for us, Sabbath is praying and playing, outdoors time, which I know is easier in California than a lot of places right now. We read a lot. We look into each other's eyes. We play music, not play music through the speakers, but we've got a piano and our kids think they can play the guitar. The 2.5-year-old really thinks he can play the guitar. But we do more creating than consuming, and we do things slowly. And I think my favorite part of Sabbath is that no one ever says the words, we're late, or hurry up, which every other day of the week, it's like, get in the car, get your shoes on, is your backpack ready? You know, I've got a meeting, the meeting is starting, we have to, and Sabbath just, you pause all of that, and there's such renewal and such grace in that gift. And it took me the longest time to start to take it. Because the world needs me to be running all the time, right?
Of course. That's how we're worthy.
Not that important. None of us are. If the president of the United States can play golf, we can take a Sabbath, right? I don't have any nuclear codes.
I threw you with so many comments about the president.
I apologize. You did.
I just went. I went there, and it was not good.
Bad place.
I'll give you the nuclear codes any day.
I noticed as you were talking, you mentioned donuts. I wonder if there are foods that are related to your Sabbath celebration, or you know, or whatever. Just how does food and the act of eating together play into the idea of rest and playfulness?
Yeah, that's a great question. Food is huge, and food is huge in scripture, and food is intimately connected to Sabbath because we have to eat. But eating can take really various forms. It can be drive-through eating, or it can be feasting eating. But if we're going to feast, usually someone is behind that, and they're doing the cooking and the washing up and the cleaning. And so how do you balance those things? Because I do most of the cooking in our house. I enjoy it. But I don't want to be scrubbing a lot of dishes on my Sabbath. And so we are good friends with the crock pot. I hear I need to get an Instapot. Or we're good friends with the pizza delivery service. But we find a way that it's a celebration without being a burden. So often I'll prep food ahead of time, and I've got that crock pot meal ready, and it's in the fridge waiting to be poured in the morning. We always do donuts, but we don't like to run out in the morning because we're all resting. There are lots of jammies. The jammies stay on as long as possible. So we have donuts in the freezer, or sometimes we bake donuts. But it's all about things that feel celebratory without taking a ton of work. I have a lot of memories as a kid of these big family celebrations that were all centered around food, and they were such a blessing to me as a kid. But when I reached junior high or high school, I remember finally, for the first time, noticing my mom and my grandma and my aunts, and they were in that kitchen at 4 a.m. and they were still in that kitchen at 4 p.m., you know, for us. And it was beautiful. But you can do that for Thanksgiving and Christmas. Don't do that for Sabbath. Find a way to enjoy that blesses every member of the household. And luckily, I have little kids. They just want fish sticks anyway. You know, they eat fish sticks 7 days a week. That doesn't feel Sabbathy to me, but they would be like, yeah, tater tots. Mom is amazing.
Shifting to the conversation a little bit to zero in more on that food piece, one of the things that I know that you write about is by the act of paying attention to not just your phone or the clutter, that you started to notice the seasons and notice what's in season. And I just wonder if you could reflect a bit on about how this process of uncluttering has affected your relationship with food and with where food comes from and how you consume it, what you create from it.
Absolutely. There comes a point, I think, for most of us where we realize we've started moving very quickly without intending to. You just add more and more and more, and the pace of life gets really crazy. And I remember thinking, I woke up one morning and I thought, I wonder what the weather is outside. And rather than doing what people have done for thousands of years, which is open a window or step outside, I picked up my smartphone and thought, oh, you know, it's going to be clear. It's not going to rain. And then I walked out the front door and it was drizzling. And I was like, no, the app said. And I realized how insane that is, right? Rather than looking outside, I had started my morning by staring at my phone and not being aware of my surroundings. And I said, okay, this isn't okay. This has got to change. So starting to think more about how the seasons shape us. My husband is from California, and when we lived in Wisconsin, I would see him kind of wilt like a flower as it got colder and darker. And now that we live in California, the rare time we have a gray day, the same thing happens. And so he's kind of my weather barometer now. I'm like, I'm not going to check the app. I'm going to step outside and then I'm going to look at Daryl. Oh, it's going to rain. He's sad. But when you slow down, you have time to pay attention. And when you begin to clear the clutter from your calendar, you begin to have the energy and the emotion to pay attention. So suddenly I'm walking through the grocery store and it isn't, okay, let's get this done, and push notification and text and tweet and email, and I'm in the line tapping something out. Suddenly I'm like, oh my goodness. Our grocery store this week had something called cotton candy grapes. I was like, I don't know what that is. That sounds amazing. Let's bring those home. They taste just like cotton candy. It was so bizarre.
That's so weird. Wow.
But I wouldn't have noticed, right? I would have just gone on my normal path because I'm important and I have things to do and I can't possibly pay attention. When we have too much, when we do too much, that's one of the first things that goes. And suddenly people become an annoyance. Tasks become an annoyance. We're just not as connected. And that shows up, I think often it shows up first in food, in those food related errands, in cooking, in serving, in hospitality. And when we slow down, we just start to be able to experience this full, beautiful range of what God has given, what God has created. So I enjoy the grocery store now, in part because I usually leave the newborn home with my husband. So it's like vacation. But I love taking the toddler and he's like, what's that? What's that? And I'm like, I don't know. Why don't you pick it up? Why don't you hold it? Why don't you look at it? You know, what's the difference between this avocado and that avocado? And it's a gift in a way that it wasn't when I was so overscheduled. I had to just push.
Would love to get your reaction. Like, as I'm looking over these chapters and the topics that you tackle, so much of it seems to be true of the way that we eat as well. So for instance, a really hugely wide ranging diet sometimes can be problematic for us, or, you know, or trying to do too much in our own kitchens can actually fill up bandwidth that isn't all that useful. Thinking about technology, and sometimes I wonder if there's an inverse relationship between the technology of our food and the nutrition of it. Sometimes that the easier it is to go to the microwave, the less filling and less joy that it actually brings to us. And so it seems to me like, you know, there's so many different ways that we can use the work that you've done to sort of help make sense of and think carefully about our lives. And it feels like food is one of those things that really just fits into this. The idea of having a Sabbath where you're allowed to celebrate. You're the second podcast guest to mention pizza just as a as a tool for joy and celebration. Even though it may not be organic and, you know, and all that kind of stuff. But it remains a celebration. It remains a restful way to eat. So that's what I'm thinking about as I'm looking at all this. And I wonder how that strikes you.
I think you're absolutely right. And food happens at least three times a day. For most of us, it's more than three times a day. So it's one of the easiest ways to start thinking about how cluttered is my life. How do I feel about food? How do I feel about mealtime? Is it always, you know, are the kids in the back eating while we drive to the next activity? Are we able to really think about seasonality and local food? Does a trip to the farmer's market sound exhausting because I'm burned out, or does that sound life-giving to me? And I think you're right. We do sometimes get hung up on all of these particularities. Is it local? Is it seasonal? Is it organic? When sometimes you do just need to sit around a pizza with friends because there probably don't need to be any dishes tonight. And that balance is really key. And we see that whole breadth in scripture, right? We see Jesus and his disciples walking through the grain field, picking grain on the Sabbath, because they're hungry and they need something to eat on their way. And then you see Jesus feasting and having these lavish meals where he sits with his disciples and really has time to enjoy. So our lives are this beautiful mixture. And when we live a life that is less cluttered, we're able to be more intentional across the board. Being more intentional doesn't mean from now on I'm on the keto diet and I'm watching everything that goes in my mouth. Being intentional means, what does hospitality look like in my life? And how does food play into that? What does Sabbath look like in my life? My son at kindergarten, when we pick him up, the first thing he says to us is not, "Hi, mommy, hi, daddy." It's, "Where's my snack?" Because food is love. He's been out of the nest all day in this intense environment. He's at a public Spanish immersion school, and Spanish is not our first language, so he's tired when we pick him up. And food is that bit of mom thought of me or dad thought of me, and I've landed back safely home. So I think uncluttering applies to almost every aspect of how we eat, of what we eat, and of who we eat with.
Well, that's a good segue into the question around hospitality. I know this is something that is important to you in your life and work as a whole, and that you have a whole chapter of it in your book. So what is that act of hospitality? I think that sometimes when I first think of that, I think that's actually adding something on, that know, okay, you want me to stop having technology, you want me to, you know, clean out my closet and fix my finances and then invite people over? I mean, right?
Stop doing everything fun and do these terrible things instead. Write my book.
Right. Yes. So how is hospitality actually part of the faithful response? And how do you do it in a way that it's not just another thing and an overwhelming thing and something that I know I get quickly caught up in, but the house needs to be clean. I need to make a fancy meal. I need to spend more on food than I have in my food budget because I need to, you know, whether it's to impress or it's out of even just a care of, oh, so-and-so's coming over. When they had us over, it was this beautiful meal and I want to reciprocate. Right. Talk to us about, give us all the answers, Courtney. How do we do this?
I have no answers, but I can tell you some of the things that have been helpful for me. I think often in a relationship, there's one person who's like, yeah, hospitality, and one person who's much more introverted and dreads it. And I'm the one who dreads it. My husband is like, let's have all the people over. And I'm like, who's going to cook for all the people? But God has kind of slowly been opening my hands and helping me realize that the table we have in our kitchen isn't my table. It's God's table. The house that we live in isn't my house. It's God's house. And what would it mean to actually live that way? But I agree with you. I often get hung up on that. How does the house look and what can I cook? And I do most of the cooking for our family, but I'm not a great cook. Like fish sticks. You heard about the fish sticks. But we've been learning by just doing it, by just stumbling in. One of the first house guests we had over when we moved in, we had our neighbor, who's right out this window, actually, his name is John. We invited him over for dinner, and he's in his mid-40s, and he's a bachelor, and I was freaking out about what we were going to cook and if the kids would behave, and we sat around our table, and our toddler buttered his hand and then grabbed John's hand because he wanted to say the opening prayer, and I was like, this is bad. Like, this is all going badly. And John thought it was hilarious. He's like, I live alone. Nothing this funny happens in my day. Like, this is amazing. And after dinner, I'm worried because the kids have to get to bed. But John was like, let me hang with Lincoln in the living room. And we didn't know, but John is a musician. And so he sat by the piano and Lincoln got out his little xylophone and they were jamming. And God gave us this beautiful gift just because we invited someone over for dinner. So I've had to lower my bar of what I consider acceptable for having house guests in. They walk in and I say, we have kids and we're glad you're here. And you kind of like, watch your step. There are Legos. But God's used that to teach me that usually the judgment I feel is not from someone else. It's from me. And God doesn't want me to live that way. And so beginning to just stumble into hospitality, not practiced, not scripted, not you can come over tomorrow because we had the cleaners yesterday, because I'm the cleaners. Daryl cleans too, but you know, we've just had to start to do it. And I have all the excuses. I'm an introvert. I work in ministry. We have tiny kids. But the more I've said, okay, we're just going to do it, the more blessing has come in through our door. And it's really, really been, it's been such a gift, and it's not a gift I knew I needed or even wanted. But it's a beautiful thing. Have people over. We one of the tips I can give is we keep a couple meals just ready. So we can make chili because most of that comes in cans. Decent chili. It's not just dump out the can, but we can make decent chili in 20 minutes, and we've always got the stuff to do it. We've got a couple freezer meals we can heat up, and they don't really taste like freezer meals. But that's part of it for me, is having someone walk in and not thinking, oh no, like we just always have one of those stocked. In the summer, we always have Otter Pops, you know, those like freezer, and that makes all the neighborhood kids want to come hang out at our house because it's 110 and we have Otter Pops. And you can buy ones that are mostly juice. So it's not even the like red food coloring, sorry, it's Southern California, we probably just poisoned your child, Otter Pops. They're like healthy. And I was inspired by a friend at church who said, you know, she actually lives in a very similar house than we do. And her sons are grown now. And she said, we're competing in Orange County with people who have pools and giant backyards and basketball courts. She's like, we live in this modest home. So I realized early on, if our sons were going to bring their friends here, we had to have some sort of food that we were known for. Let's go to the Craw's house because they're going to serve us. She's like, we were the Snickerdoodle house. So after every game, after every meet, after every practice, they would have this troop of boys come through, and they wouldn't stay forever because then they'd go to the house with the pool. But they would come and they would sit and they would talk about the game, about their lives, about who was dating who. You know, this friend was like, I have learned so much by standing in the kitchen when the snickerdoodles are out. But it can be that simple, right? Any of us can bake a snickerdoodle. You can bake a gluten-free snickerdoodle. You can bake an organic snickerdoodle if you want to. But the Otter Pops has been part of our hospitality. That was a very long answer to a very short question.
No, that's fantastic.
That was a phenomenal answer.
That's excellent. I'm just thinking about, oh, that's great. What should the thing be?
Yeah, what's your? I want to know your pantry meal when you get it figured out.
Yeah, oh, that's great. Well, I just love that idea of having something ready too, because that does trip me up. I mean, that just happened a couple of weeks ago. We ran into a friend and I was out walking. It was right before dinner, and it would have been perfect to just say, "Well, just come on over," but I didn't because I didn't quite know what we had and. I knew that the kitchen was dirty, you know, just those little barriers. So to both get over myself and not have to have the house always clean before having people over, but also to be prepared.
Hard not to go to that shame place of, well, if I would have been better at tidying up, then I could have people over.
Right.
And I've just had to let God start to break that in me. It's like, you're never going to be that good at it. It's just not what I'm good at. You know, I'm doing a lot of other things. Our house isn't, you know, going to be condemned, but we got some dust bunnies and we just come on over. You can visit them. They're friendly.
So we've been at this a little while. So I think we're going to land a plane. And we like to do that by asking, what gives you hope? And I would just like to extend that. I think just your way of saying that we can let go of some of these things. And there's a great deal of hope and joy that as I've heard you talk, just I've really enjoyed. But nevertheless, we'll ask the question that, you know, as we live in a world that seems hopelessly cluttered, whether it's our homes or sort of our mental spaces, our social spaces, whatever, what gives you hope? And not the kind of hope that looks away from all the ugliness, but the hope that anticipates that there's a better world out there. So what brings you hope?
I love this question. I thought about it. You guys sent it to me a couple of days ago and I've kind of been sitting with it. And what gives me hope is stopping. What gives me hope is Sabbath, is unplugging, is ceasing from everything I've been doing. Cause I am a doer. I will push, I will run, I will go fast. When Daryl and I were in premarital counseling, the pastor said, Courtney, you are a thoroughbred. Like, you go fast and you go hard. And I was like, thank you. And he was like, that's not a compliment. Oh shoot. You need to slow down. But I think a lot about the quote. I think it's in my Sabbath chapter in the book, the quote from Victor Hugo, where he says, when you've laboriously accomplished your daily task, go to sleep in peace. God is awake. Mm. And there's this idea that we are supposed to work hard. You know, the world is burning in a lot of ways, and God sends us out there with our watering cans to do the work that he's set before us. But we can't do everything. We're not designed to, we're not created to. So getting to the cusp of Sabbath and just putting down my tools and laying down myself and trusting that the Lord is going to be working when I can't do anymore, that gives me hope. It's not all in my hands. It's not all on my shoulders. God is making all things new. And I'm invited to be a part of that, but I'm also invited to take a break. And what a good God that is.
I appreciate that. That our listeners will as well. This is going to go live in a few days, and there'll be people all over the world listening to it, and they're all going to want to buy your book because, well, people, you should buy Courtney's book because it really is. It's
and then you can give it away so it's not cluttered anymore. Buy
that's
it
right.
And then give it away.
That's what I was thinking. I was like, okay, so I could lend my book to other people, but then I want them to also buy the book. But you, listeners, we highly recommend this book, not just because it is funny and smart and wise, but because I think there's something of the faithful message that we really need to hear and take to heart So where can people find your book? Where can people find you? How can they follow you on Twitter and get responses, you know, between 7 and 9 in the evenings?
Well, you can drive to my house and I will give you a book and an OtterPop. But if you live too far away to do that, I am on Amazon. I'm on christianbook.com. You can find the book at the publisher itself, publisher's website, hendricksonrose.com. And on Twitter, I'm just Courtney Ellis. And Facebook, my author page is authorcourtneybellis.com. And my blog, where I do 10-minute devotionals and guest posts from some really lovely, lovely people, is courtneybellis.com.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for taking the time. Thank you for putting us in your schedule. And we look forward to being in conversation with you in the future. I know that you have a second book coming out next year, so we'll for
coming
sure.
out in July. And then I'm going to take a nap.
And then a nap, yeah. So we'll look forward to talking to you again soon.
Thanks, Sam and Anna. I really appreciate the time.
Thanks for listening to the Food and Faith Podcast. Our collaborators are Wake Forest University School of Divinity, Plainsong Farm, Garden Church, and The Keep Until. And the music is by Paul Diemer. Follow along and keep up to date with the podcast on Facebook at Food and Faith Podcast, Twitter and Instagram at Food and Faith Pod, or on our website at foodandfaithpodcast.org.